You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, and welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader, brought to you by my independent bookshop, Wellington Square Bookshop, which was winner of the 2014 Best Bookshop in Philadelphia, as well as, and perhaps equally important, the Best Coffee Shop. So I'm really pleased with that, and I thank all of you listeners and readers and shoppers for helping me to achieve that goal. Today, we're lucky enough to have with us Daniel Galera, author of Blood-Drenched Beard. Daniel, although foremost an author, is also the translator into Portuguese of works by Zadie Smith, John Cheever, and David Mitchell. He also has a publishing house and several other novels. This is his first that's been translated into English. Look, there's a lot of reviews about this book that you can read and tell you what people think of it. But for me, because I have a mythological father and a mythological grandfather, what struck me the most is being part of a family that you're sure you want to find out about as much as you want and you admire, but at the same time, you're kind of frightened of the things that you might find out. And so this book is a quest. And almost a mythological quest. And so I'm looking forward to talking to you, Daniel, and thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, so one question I had at the outset was because, we just had David Mitchell on the show a couple weeks ago, and he was talking about the bone clocks. So I was wondering which of his books you translated.
I translated the one before that, I think, The Thousand Autumns.
Oh, wow.
Jacob.
It's difficult.
I read all his novels, really, but this is the only one that I translated myself.
But if you take a book like Cloud Atlas, I mean, I can't even imagine the task of translating a book like that. In fact, you know, when they made the movie, which I think butchered the book, Martin Scorsese apparently said there's no way you can. He sold the option rights because he said, I've looked at this. There's no way you can make a movie out of this book.
Yeah, Cloud Atlas is one of my favorite novels.
Me too.
And I read it maybe 1 or 2 years after it was released in UK and United States, and it blew me away at the time. It was the first book by Mitchell I read, and then I went after all his books, and I've been reading his work since then.
So have I.
I know that someone is translating Cloud Atlas to Portuguese as we speak. It's one of Brazil's best translators, so... I'm sure he's up to the job.
I don't know.
Translating The Thousand Autumns was really big challenge for me. It was one of the most difficult novels to translate in my short career as a translator. I really, really enjoy his books, and I read The Bone Clocks recently.
Yeah.
And it's just as good as...
I've always admired Vladimir Nabokov because he writes so well. And... I think maybe part of it is because English is a second language and that he can step outside of the language and look in it and has more ability to understand the nuance. But
what Nabokov did sounds to me almost impossible. I mean, there are very few people that are able to do that. But I sometimes, because I read a lot in English and I translate from English too, sometimes I find myself thinking about stories in English for a while. Really strange. I have to realize that and come back to Portuguese just because I work a lot with English too, so it can get a little confusing sometimes.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I'm very poor with languages, but I can imagine how you would just there'd be a switch in your head and you go, oh, wait a minute, I'm thinking in Portuguese, I'm thinking in English, and just kind of turn it off and on. Well, so with regard to your book and what I said in the beginning, and again, like Nabokov and like Gabriel Garcia Marquez, there's actually the grandfather is almost like a character out of Marquez. So what do you think about it in terms of, I hate to say it this way, but the magical realism idea of that part of the book and the fact that somebody who appears to be dead and in the reader's mind, oh, yeah, he's dead. Mm-hmm. Then what about that part?
Yeah. Well, I got this magical realism comparison in some reviews, and I don't really agree with that. I mean, I can understand from one point of view, because García Márquez and all the writers from the magical realism movement, they became very famous outside of Latin America. And of course, their work is great and in many senses. But me personally, as a reader, I don't enjoy very much García Márquez. I mean, I read two of his most important novels, and they really are not my thing. And this is strange, because now I get my book is being compared sometimes to García Márquez, and I can see where that comes from, but I don't really agree. I think magical realism is a whatever is sounds fantastical, fantasy, or impossible, it's supposed to be really happening. So they use that as a symbolism for existential or political issues. In my writing, and especially in Blood, Drained Beard, I don't think anything magical is really going on. I do make some a lot of realistic descriptions of superstition and stories people tell in small community about ghosts and I mean legends and myths, but it's supposed to be from a realistic point of view. So when people compare my novel to magical realism, I don't think that's the case, really. Even though I can understand more or less for a foreign reader where that similarity, supposed similarity, comes from. But the way I see it, my book is grounded on realism. So I would not put it in the magical realism shelf, definitely.
And it's funny, because when I talk to authors who don't like magical realism, they have a knee-jerk response that, no, it's not. But then if you think of the scene in which he goes into this cave area where he meets what he's been searching for all his life, it doesn't seem... I mean, I could see it happening, but the prefatory... this what happened in the bar with the lights out... and the fact that it's 100 wounds, it just seems almost, well, it does seem impossible. How could he have? And how could he now?
Yeah, but,
you know,
the point is that it probably was not 100 wounds. One idea I really tried to explore in this novel is the idea that behind most or even all of legends and myths, if we could really go back to the origin of this kind of story, the situation, whatever happened to ignite this myth, was a very simple and banal and just commonplace situation or person. Of course, we can't go back and be sure, but my idea is that behind every larger-than-life person or situation, in fact, you get really simple and just straightforward things going on. And what makes a myth is just layers and layers of story that are overlapped during time from different people that tell the story, from the trauma or whatever feelings or emotions the situation left in a community. That makes the story larger and more impressive than it probably was. So I don't really explain to the reader what really happened in the case of the murder of the protagonist's grandfather. But I suggest that maybe the stories are not really true. They're just partially true. And at the same time, I didn't want to make it a sort of crime story that I review what really happened. This was not what I was interested in. I think that more than magical realism, my reference for this novel was the kind of horror gothic tale, you know, from Edgar Allan Poe to, you know, I couldn't remember writers' names right now, but that the kind of story that you get some really menacing feeling from it, and you can feel that something dark and bad happened maybe, but you never get to the truth behind this feeling. You just work with the feeling and how it affects the characters and the reader and whoever reads the book. So I think this was story was more important for thinking about my novel than magical realism, for instance.
Well, even though his journey, and again, it almost is like Ulysses or some type of odyssey because of the perils and the hardships he goes through, and then especially at the end when he's defending the honor and life of his dog, you know, it really was like that. But the pivotal moment for me in the book came when he was in the cave and his grandfather saying, no, this is not right. You should not be here. Yeah. And that was where the book pivoted around in my eyes. But it's the concept of you're searching for something. And again, it even affects me personally, viscerally, when you're searching for something for so long and then you find it and you reject it.
That scene in the book is very special because I had a very careful planning of all the story, all the novel, before I sat down on the computer to write it. But there was one detail that I did not plan beforehand. That was the meeting between the grandson and the grandfather in the cave. So I was writing the book for maybe a year when I got to that point that I had to write that scene. So I just wrote whatever felt right in that couple of days when I was working on that scene. And so, I even knew how the book would end, but I didn't knew what would happen when they met in the cave. And so I found out myself about it when I came to that point. And what I think happens is really, this I was telling about the connection between the simple stories and people behind the myths, the legends. And when the grandson meets the grandfather, even against his own expectations, maybe, you get this collision between real life fact and the myth that was born from it. It's very symbolic. I mean, maybe this is the scene in the book that you could maybe cannot avoid maybe linking to some kind of magical realism. But So I wanted the scene to be strange, and some readers sometimes think it's some kind of delirium or illusion.
Yeah.
The character is just too tired from his walking for weeks on the hills. And, well, I don't think so. In my opinion, whatever happens is really happening. What it means, I don't have an answer, and I wouldn't tell the reader to interpret that scene.
There's a lot packed into there, you know. There's so much symbolism.
It feels weird and disturbing, and at the same time, exciting. I don't know. Well, part of the story is supposed to be really exciting.
Well, plus he's flanked by these symbolic women. You know, it's like, why are they there? How did they get there? What relationship does he have to them? And then, of course, you do throw in the fact that he leaves his backpack there.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, well, it has to be true because he doesn't have his backpack anymore. But, you know, maybe he did lose it. But yeah, it does ring. It does seem like it did happen. And then after that, you know, he goes through one more incredible crisis where he rises to the occasion in a way that most people wouldn't, almost as if he's the hero at that point, like the hero of a Greek myth.
Yeah.
He is a hero, kind of. Right?
If he's a hero?
Yeah.
Well, I never thought of this character as a hero, really.
Why does he do what he does at the end? You know, knowing that theoretically he can't.
I'm not going to go into a lot of detail because
no.
Listeners didn't read the book, but you mean the situation with the dog in the end?
Yep.
Yeah, that was not planned in the beginning when I was thinking about the book. And what happened is that the character of the dog, Beta, was not supposed to be so important as it got in the end. I had the first chapter of the novel where the protagonist's father tells him he's going to commit suicide, and he asks his son to sacrifice, to put his dog down, because he doesn't have the guts to do it himself. And what happens is his son, instead of killing the dog, he keeps the dog. So that was not supposed to be such a deal dog with him to Garopaba, to this small fisherman village where the story takes place. And the dog is there, so I start to develop his relationship with the dog. And suddenly I realized when I was writing the novel that the dog represents his father, his deceased father to him. So I got this idea that what happens if he is so attached to this dog now because he thinks of his father because of the dog, that he will do anything, whatever it takes, to keep the dog alive. So that was the initial idea that made me write several other scenes in the book, including the one you're talking about. I wanted to push it further and further. I mean, how far will this character go to keep the dog close to him and alive? So there are some situations in the novel that really test his will to save the dog and keep the dog alive and close to him. And that final scene is the climax of this conflict.
And what's
In my opinion, the dog represents the father to him, so this has a connection with all the family stuff that is spread all around the plot. And the joke is the dog can't die. He won't allow the dog to die, and he won't lose the dog no matter what. So that makes him do things that are more and more extreme in order to keep that promise to himself.
And the very interesting thing is the very precept of keeping the dog is he's violating his father's last wish.
Yeah, and he doesn't feel good about it.
No.
He has one conversation with another character, the Buddhist character, about this guilt he feels that he did not attend his father's last wish. And the Buddhist friend says, well, no problem, because you know, the dog is alive, and you like the dog likes you, and nobody's suffering because of it, on the opposite, I mean. And he says, yeah, I know, I agree with you, but even so, I did not do what my father's last wish, you know. He called me just to ask that. So he feels bad about it, and there is this paradox in his attitude towards the dog. So that was really, I did it consciously, you know. It's one of the situations the character is really facing all the time during the story.
How much of the book is, well, let's just take one section. How much of the book is autobiographical in the sense of the protagonist's athletic endeavors? And, you know, I know a little bit about you, but, you know, triathlete and diving into freezing cold water, which I would never do. How much of that is you?
Well, not a lot, but it really depends from which point of view you see this matter. I lived myself in Garopaba for 1 year and a half. This was the time when I was researching for the novel. But I didn't move to Garopaba to research the novel because I didn't know I was going to write this book when I moved there. I just wanted to have the kind of experience my character is looking for in the beginning of the story. And I mean, swimming is one of my greatest passions. I really love to swim, and especially swimming in the sea, in the ocean. That's not something I can do very often because I usually live in big cities. You know, I lived in Porto Alegre and in São Paulo. These are very big urban environments where I can't go to the sea to swim often. I have to swim in swimming pools and clubs. So one of the reasons I moved to Garopaba was to be able to swim every day in the morning, just wake up and dive in the sea and have a swim. So you see, this part of the book, his connection with the swimming and the ocean and all his feelings and observations about water and exercise, that has a lot to do with my own experiences. But I'm not an athlete, and I mean, I never practiced triathlon, and I was never any kind of competitor in anything. I just do it for myself. So it's really enlarged to fit the character in this case. So it is autobiographical from one point of view, and it's not on another. And if you think of the book as a whole, I wouldn't say it's autobiographical because the story itself, the plot, is pretty much made up. The protagonist's family has nothing to do with my real family, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, several characters you meet in the book are maybe loosely based on people people I really met in Garopaba or met in other places and imagined living in Garopaba. I don't know. So, of course, like most fiction, maybe all fiction, it is connected to my personal life in a sense. But I wouldn't call this novel autobiographical. That wouldn't be proper, I think.
I just spent some time in Key West, Florida, and it's almost as if time slows down, because everyone there is divorced from the rest of the world in the sense that they don't need to know about it. And yeah. It gives you this feeling, you slow down too, and I'm thinking to myself, this is really nice. I would really like to do this rather than go back to a big city. Plus, in America, when I came back, I had a 70-degree differential in temperature. It was 75 degrees there, Fahrenheit, and it was 5 degrees in Philadelphia when I landed. So it was, I would have been better off staying in my freezer because there's no wind chill there. But I can kind of understand. It's nice to be able to open your back door and there's the ocean and you walk right into it. There's something very pleasant about his lifestyle.
Yeah, that's what I was doing myself when I was researching for the book. I didn't write the book when I was living in Garopaba. I started writing it only when I moved away from Garopaba and came back to Porto Alegre. But of course, this feeling of just having this close relationship with the sea and this small town that has all its life, you know, revolving around the ocean, this has a lot to do with what the novel became in the end. But the story is mostly fiction, so the reader can decide how autobiographical that sounds, but I don't think it's too autobiographical. I see that it's most as fiction.
Of all your novels, this being the one that's been translated to English, was it your choice, or did your publisher or agent just decide now it's time for you to start expanding your horizons with regard to your books?
Oh, no, no. I have an agent for international publishers since my first book, so it's been more than 10 years. And some of my previous novels, they were published in places like Portugal and Italy, but it's very, very hard to get translated into English. The American and the English market, they're relatively close to foreign writers, so it's very hard to do that. And I got lucky with this novel because, for many reasons. First, for some reason, this book seems to work with foreign readers more than my previous books. And also, we had, a couple of years ago, Brazil was the guest of honor in the Frankfurt Book Fair, which is the most important publishing fair in the world. And so Brazilian government did an extra effort to try to get Brazilian writers translated into other languages. And my book was published shortly before the fair. So many foreign publishers were looking for new Brazilian writers at that time. And my book got in the hands of readers from a German publisher, Surkamp. They really loved the novel, and they decided to buy the rights for Germany even before the book was published here in Brazil. So that got a word of mouth going on, and the end result is that the book is now being published in almost 15 countries. So at some point, American and English publishers got interested too. So I got my translation into English. This is very difficult to happen with a Brazilian writer. So there were several circumstances that were joined in making it possible for me to have my debut novel in the United States. And I'm very, very happy about it because I have this relation with American literature since I was a teenager. I always read a lot of American authors. Then I started to translate American authors as a job. And now I'm really, really happy that my book is in the American market. It's something I don't have many ambitions as a writer, but one thing I used to dream about was to have one of my novels published in the United States. So,
who were your idols when you were a youth with regard to American literature?
I'm sorry?
Who were your idols when you were a youth with regard to American literature?
When I was younger, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, one of the first writers that made me want to become a writer too was Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah.
He's widely translated into Portuguese. So I was maybe 13 or 14 when I was reading his stories, and they just blew me away. And then I read Philip Roth when I was maybe 14, 15, and got really mad about Philip Roth, so I read all his novels. More recently, David Foster Wallace and Cormac McCarthy. So I have to just look at my bookshelf here. Donald Barthelme, Thomas Pynchon, David Smith, you name it.
Well, so did you
go on? Yeah.
So those you read in English, correct?
Sometimes depends.
Because
nowadays I read American authors all in English, but when I was younger, I would just grab whatever book I could get my hands on. So I read some in English, some in Portuguese.
Because I can't possibly imagine how Infinite Jest could be translated into Portuguese, or any language for that matter.
Yeah, I read that one in English in 2004, I think. And now, I mean, a couple of months ago, the Brazilian translation of Infinite Jest just got published.
Really?
I
don't know what's wrong with me. I can't even imagine how someone could be so intelligent and so conversant with two languages to be able to do that. It's just, footnotes, just the footnotes alone.
The guy that translated, had a new translation of Ulysses from James Joyce in Portuguese recently, and he's also the translator of several Thomas Pynchon and Ellis Smith books into Portuguese. So he's really, really good, and he's very young. He's not even 40 years old.
So if you can translate Gravity's Rainbow, and how can you possibly translate James Joyce's Ulysses? It's impossible. It'd be like translating Finnegan's Wake. I can read it in English, and I have no idea what I'm reading.
That kind of book is just too much for me as a translator. I translated some tricky stuff. I mean, I translated Irvine Welsh into Portuguese, the Transporting Trilogy, that's written in that dialect. Scots dialect.
I don't know how you could.
So that was probably the hardest thing I ever did. But, you know, Hunter Thompson, for example, it's very, very hard to translate into Portuguese. It's just so American. His references are so specific and American that you have to do a lot of research to translate. You know, every paragraph demands a huge amount of research. But that's as far as I go as a translator. I mean, I don't think I'm able to go into Thomas Pynchon or something like that. It's just too much. But I did translate some of Foster Wallace's essays into Portuguese. Not his fiction, but his essays.
I translated
half a dozen into Portuguese.
It's funny, when I asked a really stupid question once, because when I was like 12 or 13, I read all of Hermann Hesse, and I was just enthralled with it, from Steppenwolf and Damien, all those books. And then when I was in college, there was a German professor, and I asked him, I said, well, how are the translations of these books? He goes, why in God's name would I read the translations?
Yeah.
And I thought about that for a moment. I didn't ever really make the connection.
Yeah, he has a point. I mean, you do lose a lot in translation. It's impossible to just retain everything from the original. There's a limit to translation. But on the other hand, these limits, they allow the translator to be creative about it. And so the best translators, they are sort of writers too. I mean, they are writing fiction a little bit too, because they have to find out a way to recreate this in another language that will be the most faithful rendition of the original. Sometimes to be faithful to an author, you have to be unfaithful to his source material. I think it's the truth about translation. Of course, you cannot change what's going on. I mean, to get the most precise translation, sometimes you have to change it a little bit.
Translation
as a kind of creative work, too.
You want to pass the emotion on to the reader. It's not the written word. It's the emotion that the reader feels, and that sometimes, I guess, that makes it. It's like there's two things. Like in Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis, there's two translations, and one says, Gregor Samsa woke one morning from troubled dreams to find himself transformed in his bed into a giant cockroach. And then the other one, it says a giant insect.
Yeah, yeah, that's it's an infinite debate about what exactly he turned into. Nobody knows.
But it's a cockroach. I know it's a cockroach. And I want it to be a cockroach so badly that I reject a translation that says insect. Just like in Camus' The Stranger, when he's dying and he's excoriated by the crowd, but he accepts the benign indifference of the universe, the new translation changes that all around, and I'm so used to the old one, and it made so much sense, and I really feel like I'm at your mercy, you know?
Yeah. You just have to be real good in German in order to get to the truth. There's no way around it.
Yeah, it's definitely a complete different world for me. Well, so actually now, if you talk about translation, now I'm assuming that what will happen with Blood Drenched Beard, if it hasn't happened already, is that someone's going to option the movie rights for it, because you could make it into a screenplay quite easily, I think.
Yeah, the adaptation rights for movies, they were sold to a Brazilian production company a couple of years ago. So I think they have the rights, the international rights. So this is probably going to be first a Brazilian production, unless something really unexpected happens that I'm not aware of. But there should be a movie in the next couple of years, but made in Brazil.
Yeah, I think it would be, as a reader, you always think of it, and then you try to imagine who it would be and things like that. But, they would change it completely. Yeah, who knows what Hollywood would do with it. They would turn it, and it would be California, and it would be a different kind of thing completely.
I don't know. I always feel it's a bad idea to turn my books into movies. People ask me, or tell me that your book really feels like could be a great movie, and I always disagree. I mean, there's something about them that doesn't seem very,
cinematic.
Yeah. I don't have the word in English for it, but I just have a hard time trying to imagine how they could film it. But apparently, many people disagree with me because they think my movies could be turned into movies.
I mean, think about it.
You
think about the swimming pool scenes and the interesting people that he's teaching to swim, and then the barroom scenes and stuff like that. Those seem like they could be translated in a very interesting and exciting way. But maybe you're right. It's like we were talking about with David Mitchell. They should never have tried to translate Cloud Atlas into a movie.
I saw the movie, and maybe they did what was possible to do with that book, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it was a good idea from the start, but since they were doing the movie, they actually had some great ideas on how to deal with the kind of story they got. But, of course, there was a limit to what could be done from the beginning. I had a great time watching the movie, but I was glad I read the book before.
Yeah, and of course, they're
remembering how amazing the situation in the book were, and say, okay, this makes me remember that, and it's good.
And you're always limited by time as well. That book could have been a 10-hour movie.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just too attached to my books. Maybe they will make great movies, and I'm just too attached to whatever details I gave them, and I know a lot of that's going to be lost in the adaptation, but that's normal.
Well,
good translators have to change a little bit their source material. Great movie makers, their make adaptations, they also have to change it. And they can change it for worse, but they can change it for better. And if they usually adaptations to the movies that are too literal, they're not good.
Well, you have the benefit, the luxury in your situation now of having, I assume, read the translation of your book. So you have the unique ability to, the only person in the world, I guess, who can tell the difference between what you wrote and what was translated. So how do you feel about that?
Oh, yeah. I really like Alison's translation. I think it's very, very faithful to the mood and the kind of dialects and the idioms that people use in my book. She was very careful about that, and when I read her translation, it kind of resembles the voice I had in my mind when I was writing it in Portuguese. You know, so I really feel it's a faithful translation. I think she did a great job. And I've seen some reviewers and some readers of the translation complaining that something sound a little odd. I'm pretty sure that in most cases, whatever sounds odd was odd in the original too. I cannot be sure because in most cases, I don't know exactly what they sound odd, but when weird. I read the translation, I think just preserved a weird kind of narration that I tried to achieve in Portuguese.
But look
so
what you said. Look what you just said.
I really think that the translation is very successful.
But just think of what you said 5 minutes ago. We were talking and you said, I can't find the English word for it. So if you can't find the English word for it, that must happen a lot. So what do you do? What do you do then? If you can't find the English word for it.
Oh, you just have to change it. I mean, you have to come up with something that's creative and will have the same effect, the same result in the other language. I mean, that's possible. That's always possible.
You know,
always a way to do it.
I always, you know, since I read the book and I enjoyed it so much, I love talking about it, but I always assume that my listeners are as well versed in it when it just came out in January. So before we end, why don't you just give us a synopsis, a concise summary of what the book's about so we can actually sell some of your books, which is why you're here.
Okay, I can try to do that. Well, the novel is about, there is an unnamed protagonist. And I'm sorry about that because we have to call him the protagonist all the time. It's awful. But he doesn't have a name in the book. And, well, this is a guy in his 30s. And in the beginning of the book, his father calls him to his house to announce he's going to commit suicide. And he wants him to put his dog down because he doesn't have the courage to do it himself. So the father actually commits suicide, but the son keeps the dog. And before ending his conversation with his son, the father tells him about the life of his grandfather that he knew almost nothing about. And he finds out that his grandfather was murdered in very mysterious circumstances in a small fishing village in the south coast of Brazil called Garopaba. So in the second chapter, the character has already moved to Garopaba, and we realize he's going to go after the story of whatever happened to his grandfather. He finds from a picture that an old photograph that he looks a lot like his grandfather, and the protagonist has a feature that's a little weird, that he cannot recognize faces, which is an actual disease called prosopagnosia or face blindness. So that's an important part of the plot, too. So he's in this new town, and at the same time that the book chronicles his life, he's in this new place, this fishing village, where he becomes a swimming instructor and so on. At the same time, he's doing slowly this investigation about what happened to his grandfather. And he realizes his grandfather became this mythical, menacing figure or myth in the community. So people start to get a little bit aggressive towards him. And, well, until the end, we'll find out what happened to the grandfather, maybe. But I think the book is mostly about this guy that's finding his place in this small fishing village after a lot of difficult and hard stuff happened in his emotional and his family life. So it's a story. I see it more as an existential novel than a mystery novel. It's a little bit of both in my point of view. And, well, hope this is enough to get you interested in the novel and you can read it and have your own conclusions.
Yeah, I think it definitely is. And like I said, you know, when I get these books to review, sometimes I'm not sure, do I want to read this blood-drenched beard? What does that mean to me? And then once you get into it, it's almost compelling because I think a lot of people can identify, not the factual situation, but they can identify, well, there's other issues we haven't talked about with regard to his brother and that issue, but there's a lot of issues that people can identify with, and that's what draws you in, whether it's one or the other. So I'm glad I've begun reading you. I hope, since I'm not going to learn Portuguese, I hope that some of your other books are translated into English, or you write them in English, although you said you can't do that. But
yeah, I think one of my previous novels, another one, it's going to be published by Penguin Press, too.
Well, I look forward to it. And thank you so much.
Me too.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Daniel. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure, and I hope the listeners can find a book and read it, and that you have a great time.
I think they will. That was Daniel Galera speaking about his new novel, Blood-Drenched Beard. There's a big rise in Brazilian authors now. I think McSweeney's has a whole collection of nothing but Latin American writings. And as Daniel was talking about, there's the Frankfurt Book Fair, which is the biggest book fair in the world, and he just happened to luck out by getting his book published just as the fair was starting, so it went there, and then he got the English rights. It's the first novel he's written that's in English, and I'm looking forward to his other novels being translated. In any event, it's a really good book, and it does explore the dynamics between fathers, sons, grandfathers, and all kinds of other things that, even though he says it's not magical realism, there's definitely certain elements of the mythological in there, and as I said, more almost like Ulysses or Odysseus and his travels and things like that. In any event, a very interesting interview. I love interviewing international authors. They're such a different viewpoint. And also, he's a great translator and translated David Mitchell's Bone Clocks, and David Mitchell was here talking about Bone Clocks some weeks ago, so that was neat. Anyway, so next week we will welcome William Nicholson to discuss his latest work, Amherst, which I think I talked about. It's about Emily Dickinson's brother and how he was having an affair with this married woman, and then Emily Dickinson lent her dining room to them where they could have sex, and then she would listen to them having sex outside the dining room door, which I find a little hard to believe, but after reading the book, and it'll be up to you and him to decide whether it really did happen, but it's a fascinating concept. So I hope you'll join us next week when we talk to William Nicholson about Amherst, which is a lot more interesting than you would think any book about Emily Dickinson would be.
You've been listening to the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.